are continuing this series on the life of Jacob. And we are, what I'm going to do today is, like I have been doing, because the story is so, the story itself is just amazing. You know, you can almost, sometimes I feel like, why don't I just read this and then go home? Because it really speaks so deeply. It's just, it really, for me, things like this story are what really get me excited about God's word and just to know just the depth of it. Because you can't make this stuff up. You know, when you read it, it's just so well, it's genius, the way it's written. And what we're going to do today, we've been talking about Jacob and the issues of scheming, deceiving, manipulation. Well, we use the term control freak today, and that's what Jacob was a control freak. And so we've been going through that in his life because either we tend to have issues with control or we know people in our lives, there's important people in our lives like bosses and things who have issues with control and we need to learn how to deal with those. We've primarily been focusing on ourselves. Today we're going to do a little bit of focusing on the other person. So after I read the story and towards the end I'm going to have some practical things of what to do if you're in a situation where there's a person who's controlling and manipulating, and how do you deal with that? Because that's true for many. All of us will have that at some point. There's just no getting around it. Sometimes it's much worse than others. So to verse 29:1. Then Jacob continued on his journey. So Jacob, and I'll get this, but you know he had to leave because his brother's going to kill him because he stole all his stuff. And it's basically the modern way of saying it. And if we did a new kind of modern Broadway version of this. Then Jacob continued on his journey. It's a 550-mile journey. And came to the land of the eastern peoples. There he saw a well. It kind of sounds almost like, what's his name? Lord of the Rings guy. The land of the eastern peoples. That's probably where he got it from. There he saw a well in the open country with three flocks of sheep lying near it because the flocks were watered. Watered? Okay. Well, every now and then, Connecticut drops back in on me without me knowing. As you know, I was raised in Connecticut, and it just kind of pops in there. Been here for a whole long time. Watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him," they answered. Then Jacob asked them, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep." Very convenient little quote there. "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It is not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to pasture." "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away." While he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was their shepherd. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. Before we get jumping into this, there is a little theme here, a story, a little narrative, the term uses a motif, that comes up over and over again in scriptures, and it's right here. This is where it begins. And this theme or story goes like this. Man leaves his home. That's the first stage. Man goes on a long journey. Man stops at a well. Man meets a woman, man gets married. And that theme comes up over and over and over again in the Bible. And I'm just not going to have time to go through that theme. There is an ultimate conclusion to that theme, and you can guess what it is. It is a man who leaves his home. And his home is the perfect home, and it's far away. And he goes to a distant land, a foreign land, and he finds his bride in that land. But the story comes up over, and there's variations on this story. Sometimes it's not a well, but it's somebody asks for a drink. Sometimes it's somebody offers a drink. And so it just, as you're reading, I'll leave it there. It is an interesting little story, and it, of course, it all points to Jesus Christ. You'll see it with Moses. You'll see it in a number of other places, especially in the Old Testament, but some in the New. Continue on with Jacob's story, verse 12 then. He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah, so she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home. And there Jacob told him all these things. So here we have Jacob, and we've been going through his troubles and tribulations. And all of a sudden, it seems as if fortune is finally smiling down on Jacob. Or maybe God is smiling down on Jacob. Or maybe not. Progression of events have taken place. First, we started with Jacob lies to and deceives his father on his deathbed. And then he steals his brother's stuff. He steals his brother's blessing. He has to flee the wrath of his brother. He goes on this great journey. And then, as we looked at last week, as he's camping outside of Bethel, he has this incredible encounter with God. And it often, directly after a God encounter, it seems, even for us, it's like if we have this experience of God, maybe we go to a conference, you know, whatever it's on, we go to a conference and a women's retreat or a marriage conference or something, and God really speaks to us. Or maybe there's a big prayer we've been praying for a long time, and that prayer finally gets answered, or we see some kind of what we might call a miracle, and we have this encounter with God. Right after that, often what happens, it will seem like all is right with the world. And we will begin to ask ourselves questions like, how did I ever doubt? Or we'll say things like, you know, God did this, I will never doubt again. But the reality is things tend to turn. The story goes on. Laban said to him, "You are my own flesh and blood." After Jacob had stayed with him for a whole month, Laban said to him, "Just because you are a relative of mine, you should work for me for nothing. Tell me what your wages should be." There's a little hint in here that we probably don't see, but those in that day would have understood with this little statement of Laban's, "What will your wages be?" And it's a hint that tells us that, and would have told them, the original readers of this, that all is not yet right with Jacob. So all is not yet right with Jacob's world. Jacob is still the schemer, the original great deal maker, like we talked about last week. But what's about to happen is Jacob is about to meet his match. Another great deal maker named Laban, another schemer. And it just so happens to be his uncle. Isn't it odd? We looked at his mom, Rebecca, and she's a deceiver and a schemer. And then we have Jacob, and he's a deceiver and a schemer. And now we have the uncle, and he's a schemer and a deceiver, a manipulator. And we're about to see these two schemers. It's going to be a prize fight of heavyweight proportion. It's about to take place. And we don't have time for this, but I'm just going to mention it so you can consider it yourself down the road. Is there is always something about families of origin. that we can always go back two or three generations at any point in a family, and there are things that are there that are unhealthy. It's always that way. Every family's always that way, even the best. Families are that way. And we could, and what most families do is they shove that stuff under the rug and they just keep it there. And I just want to urge you, and it takes a lot of work sometimes to go through all this, but there's times where at some point we just need to go there. We need to pick up the rug. Start pulling all the dust out. You know, at our house, Cindy and I do that once in a while if we have visitors. You know, you got to clean. Somebody's coming over. And once in a while, we have visitors to our souls. And we need to go in there and get the dust that nobody usually sees. That's, you know, a month-long, six-month series, but I'll just throw that out to you. There's lots of stuff out there you can find to help with that. Story goes on. Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, okay, Laban threw out the hook with the bait, and Jacob's about to bite. I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Isaac, go back to Isaac. Jacob comes in. He's got goat skin on and Esau's clothes. And Isaac was blinded by his old age. Jacob is blinded by love. He's completely oblivious to what he is stepping into. And Laban seizes the advantage. And just as Jacob, we look at Jacob and he was this opportunistic guy who took what he could from Esau. So now Laban will do the same with Jacob. He will use Jacob to enrich himself. The story goes on. Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me. Sounds so innocent. But it is anything but so innocent. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. That sounds so romantic. You know, it's just, oh, so wonderful. 7 years went by like a day because of his love for it. And that's probably is, you know, the way love works. Maybe. But Jacob is oblivious to what's going on, and he's allowing himself to be bamboozled. To quote Muhammad Ali, this is a case of the classic rope-a-dope. Here, Laban is a roping a dope. He knows exactly what he is doing. He's clueless, Jacob is. Jacob does not have yet, he hasn't developed the characteristic of prudence. Prudence is the ability to see future consequences of current actions. The ability to see future consequences of current actions. Jacob is unable to do that yet. And goes on, verse 21. Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. This is after he does the 7 years of service. My time is completed, and I want to make love to her. So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and Jacob made love to her, and Laban gave his servant Zilpah to his daughter as her attendant. What goes around comes around. The irony cannot be missed. Jacob has to go back to, it takes us back to the goat skins and the brothers' clothes. And then in verse 25, when morning came, you know, that the story is so fantastic. It's like, how in the, you know, all you can do is think, try and get our heads wrapped around, how in the world does this happen? When morning came, there was Leah. I love the way it says that. I mean, you know, just puts it right there. So Jacob said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Now, at this moment, you know, if it was making a movie, what they would do is they would have a flashback to Esau coming into Isaac with all the food he had prepared to receive his blessing, and Isaac going, Esau saying, Father, I have come for my blessing, and I've prepared the food you have told me, and Isaac going, who are you? And who just left? What goes around comes around. Jacob is about to reap what he sowed. His experience will be no different than the experiences he caused. What he did to others now is being done to him. Just like Esau in anguish could not get a blessing, so Jacob. Now here's his words. And it's funny, it's almost identical to what Esau said. I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? Esau said, that brother of mine has deceived me twice. Laban replied, and this is great. I love this. It is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Wow. Younger, older, younger, older, younger, older. It's got to be ringing in his ears painfully, like an ear infection. Finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work. Jacob cannot escape himself. And here's the reality for us, neither can we. We cannot escape ourselves. Wherever we go, we bring us with us. And so we need to learn to address us first. We need to learn how to address our own issues. It's got to be a part of who we are. First week I said that God is in conflict with the way of the world when it comes to the older son, younger son deal that was so important in their society. We saw that God in the Old Testament bears this out over and over again. God is in conflict with that. What we have now is Jacob is in conflict with the way of the world. When the world benefits us, we're good with that. When the way of the world benefits us, we're good with the way of the world. When the way of the world doesn't benefit us, we're not so good with the way of the world. It's kind of like the Electoral College. When our person wins because of the Electoral College, we think, yeah, that's good. The founders put that in there. And when our person loses, we want to change the whole thing. Same in this way. In reality, Jacob is in conflict with the way of God. That's Jacob's issue. He is living in conflict with God's ways. The story goes on. I'm going to finish it up here. And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah. Then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her attendant. Jacob made love to Rachel also, and his love for Rachel was greater than his love for Leah. So we have another family of origin thing here, and this goes back to Abraham, and that is favoritism. We saw it with Isaac and Rebekah, with Esau and Jacob, but there's favoritism that runs through this family, and it eats this family apart throughout the course of the Old Testament. And then it says this, and I love this. It says, and he worked for Laban another 7 years. What's missing? And it felt like a day. Doesn't say that. And as you read the story, you get the sense that it felt like 107 years for Jacob at this point. We're going to stop that story there and just a little application for the real world, for us. And what I would like to start and look at a little bit is what do you do when you are under, for some reason, you are in relationship with a schemer like Jacob, a manipulator. Maybe it's at work, maybe it's in another situation, maybe it's in a family situation or a friend or whatever. And I will start by saying this, is that I'll give a caution. There are some situations that are so, where people are so broken that there's really not much that can be done. There are just some situations like that. And some of these things I mention as practical advice for this may in some cases really be of no benefit. And that's just a reality. There are some cases we just need to leave. Sometimes we can't. Sometimes we're stuck being in some form of relationship with somebody who's manipulative and scheming and deceiving. And in those cases, maybe all we can do is pray. And I hate to say that, sounds trite. It's kind of like saying, you know, Jesus in Sunday school. It's always the right answer. But sometimes that's all we can do. And sometimes we may need to apply Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount where he says, love your enemies and pray for those who mistreat. And that may be all you can do in some cases. Is love your enemy. But there are times where we can have influence. And that's what I'm going to focus on today. And when we're in a situation where maybe we can have influence, there are some things we can do when there's somebody who's manipulative or scheming. The first one, and this sounds probably counterintuitive, but is to walk a mile in the shoes of the manipulating person. To learn to have empathy. And what this means is this, is we need to understand why the person is the way they are. A person becomes manipulative and scheming like this for reasons. They have been through some very, very difficult things that have made them this way. Now, we want to be empathetic, not to excuse their behavior. There's a difference. Empathy should not excuse the way somebody, when somebody behaves improperly or wrongly or hurtfully. But what empathy would do, and what walking in their, you know, wearing their sandals kind of a thing does, is it allows us to relate to them in a way that is compassionate, patient, and gracious. That's really step one. Trying to be compassionate, gracious, and patient. Again, there are some folks where that's just going to be of no benefit because they are just so unchangeable. And that's a different situation. But often the case, a person has just been hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt. And they've become this way because of it. And we're not going to be able to make any progress in that circumstance if we don't understand that. Second thing, and these are pretty simple. When appropriate, speak the truth in love to the person. When appropriate. And what I say by that is, is there again, some people will do not want to hear from you. And if that's the case, it does no good to speak. And you know when you're in a situation where, like if you've been working with somebody and, you know, you've tried really hard and nothing's working. And it's because there's a person who's, they're going to have nothing to, they want nothing to do with any advice from you, any help, anything. They are set and bent on doing it their own way. And, you know, that's a tough situation. Like I say, pray. Love your enemies in those kind of circumstances. But a large part of the problem sometimes is we just don't want to get into it. We're afraid, or we're, for some reason, just aren't willing to get our hands dirty and speak the truth to a person. And be able to say, you know, and one thing, and I mentioned this, is in doing this, I would encourage you to ask the person and to say words like, can I share some stuff with you that I've noticed, or something like that? Because by asking them, you give them the ability to give you permission to speak into their lives. If they say no, then you're done. That's it. If you want to then continue, then you become the manipulator. And then you address the situation however it is. You know, if you're the boss and you say to your employee, could we talk about some things that might help you? And they say, no. Well, then you're done. And you say to them, oh, okay, we're done. Pack up your stuff and go. Our tendency is like, oh, we need to. Well, they said no. But here's the good thing about this. If they say yes, do you know what they just did? They gave you permission. And now they have personally placed themselves in a situation where they must hear from you. Because they asked you to, by you asking the question. I think that's just it's a helpful thing. And to do that honestly, it's not trickery. Because if they say no, then you're done. Third thing, people who tend to manipulate, and then and understanding why they are that way, we must learn to, with those folks, communicate thoroughly, often, clearly, give them all the information we possibly can. And the reason that is because control issues come from insecurity and fear. That's where control issues do not come from a place of power. They come from a place of weakness, insecurity, and fear. That's how people get into controlling. And so the more you can communicate, the more that person will have at least knowledge and information they need so that they can not be insecure, fearful. When this is possible, again, with some you can tell them all you want, and they're never going to listen. And then this fourth thing, and it might be a little confusing, and I felt like, first service, to be honest, I felt like I just didn't have enough development of this, but there's a book, and I forgot the name of the author, but it's called Failure of Nerve is the name of the book. It's not a Christian book, but he uses this phrase called becoming a non-anxious presence. And What he means by that is that, and he says this, he says, it's a psychology business book is what it is. And it's, he's a psychologist who is engaged in the business world, helping businesses create environments that work for people. That's what the book is about. And he says, and he also talks about works in nonprofit and religious organizations. But he said that America is chronically anxious and it's destroying us. It's destroying relationships, our chronic anxiety. And what he says is that anxiety and engaging in systems and relationships, and you know, that's work or in the family or in churches and other organizations, that being an anxious presence in those tense circumstances is a sign of emotional immaturity. And that the real need is emotional maturity in our society, in our businesses, in our organizations. And what being a non-anxious presence is, it's the ability to separate our emotions from those of the, in this situation, from those of the manipulating person. Separate our emotions, our emotional responses, from those of the environment that have been created in the business, organization, whatever it is. And the reason being is that controlling and manipulating people use the anxiety of others as power to control more. They feed on our anxieties and fears in order to gain more and more control and manipulate more and more. And what is so critical at that point is for us to be able to stand in that situation emotionally mature in a sense of, and what a lot of this relates to is being able to have full trust in God, know ourselves, what some call really have a grasp of how to live within our true selves, those values, to hold to those values, convictions, inner things that we know to be true no matter what the outward circumstances are, and then to enter into and engage those relationships in that way. That is really the key to this whole thing. I was mentioning this, and just children, you know, they learn how to be great manipulators from infancy, don't they? Now, they do it innocently, and it's probably a good thing at first, but they cry, they get fed, they cry, they get changed, they cry, they get held and loved. And of course, that's innocent and a great thing, but their brains are working. And at about 3 years old, maybe two, maybe four, they begin to realize, this worked for feeding, changing, and loving. Let's see what else this will work for. And we've all been there and have experienced that. And just like what parents need to do, and I'll acknowledge it as parents, I know when those stages first hit us in our parenting, it was like the anxiety in Cindy and I built up. And let me ask, does that help? No. Okay, let's all say it. No. We must learn how to be that non-anxious presence. We have a mistake in our thinking. We connect our anxiety with our level of engagement and concern. That's what we do as humans. We connect our level of anxiety in a positive way, that has some way positively shows my level of engagement and concern. That's not really true. We tend to view the non-anxious, calm person as disengaged. Now, there is a way, this is a caution, there is a passiveness that is manipulative and not engaged. You know, passive-aggressive and all that. I'm not talking about that. But a non-anxious presence is somebody who is emotionally stable yet fully engaged. And that's different. Emotionally mature yet fully engaged. Passive-aggressive is just the calm way of manipulating. The quiet way of manipulating. I'm going to close with this because, and just mention what's really critical, and I'll just tell this story. Because what's really critical about all this is when we enter into this, you know, we got to work, a boss is just, you know, it's just, we can't take it anymore. And maybe you need to leave, but if you can't and you're there and you think there's some hope, the most important thing is who we are. That's the most important thing. And I'll just close with the John Ortberg story. And when and those of you who've been through the soul keeping know this one, so I'm not telling you anything new, but he tells the story about how he asked Dallas Willard, he was concerned about his church not experiencing spiritual formation the way they needed to, and he said, what do I need to do to get the people in my church to experience spiritual formation? And Dallas Willard looked at him and said, John, you need to live your life in such a way as you experience the complete joy and contentment of the presence of God as often as you can. And John looked and said, Dallas, I don't think you understand my question. What I'm asking for is, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about the people in my church and how I can see them be spiritually formed into the image of Christ. And Dallas said, John, I know exactly what you were asking me. He says, well, I was hoping you'd give me like a program or something. He says, John, I know what you're saying. But he said, John, what you need is to live your life in such a way as you experience joy and contentment in the presence of Christ. He said, John, the problem isn't the people in your church. Is you can't take them anywhere you haven't already been. The issue is you. And it's really good for us all to just at times say, you know, the issue is me. I try to do that on a regular basis. In my marriage with Cindy, the issue is me. In my work, the issue is me. And I just close with that. It's okay. I don't do anything, oh gosh. I do that for a second or two, but then I go, no, okay, the issue is me. What do I need to do? How can I take my responsibility here? Let's pray. Lord, I just ask that you would help us. Lord, it's hard. We don't want to be the issue. I don't want to be the issue. But we all are issues. The boss is an issue, but I am an issue. Spouse is an issue, but I am an issue. The kids are issues, but I am an issue. We all recognize that we have our stuff that needs to be dealt with. Boy, God, how things would change. How wonderful that would be. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen. A lot of good thoughts there. It was Edward Freeman. I put a link to that on the... Also, there was more in the first service, and I'd tell the first service people that there's more in the second because there were different things, but you might want to look at the notes online because there's some really good things there, too. Let's stand and sing one last song.
Greater than all we ask.
a great Mother's Day. Thanks for coming today.